man who passes the sentence should swing the sword.
I've won every battle, but I'm losing this war.
Show them how it feels to lose what they love.
Everyone is mine to torment.
The long night is coming. Dead, come with it.
Beware, spoiler phobes. You have stumbled upon a storm of spoilers, a podcast about HBO's Game of Thrones series in conjunction with the Song of Ice and Fire books by George R.R. Martin. This discussion can expand to include any Game of Thrones relevant books, shows, internet extras, special features, teases, trailers, interviews, rumors, guesses, theories, and general crackpotitude. We're not ruining, we're enriching. After all, chaos isn't a pit, it's a ladder. You do not wish to be spoiled or are not caught up, please stop now.
The realm. Do you know what the realm is? It's the thousand blades of Aegon's enemies. A story we agree to tell each other over and over till we forget that it's a lie. But what do we have left? Chaos. A gaping pit waiting to swallow us all. Chaos isn't a pit. Chaos is a ladder.
Hello and welcome back to A Storm of Spoilers. My name is Dave Gonzalez, and I have not read any books by George R.R. Martin, which it turns out was sort of important. But I have been up to date with Game of Thrones, which is back for season 6 on HBO.
Hi, I'm Joanna Robinson. I've read all of the books in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire. And that's still relevant, I swear. That's all I have to say.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I have read all of the books in George R. R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire series, and I've read a bunch of Reddit pages.
Hey, I mean, I'm slowly getting less. I used to be all about like the internet spoilers. And I took some time off in the off season to sort of let myself grow ignorant in hopes that it would make for some crazy theorizing. But now that we're back, I realize that I missed a really active online Game of Thrones community. Not that there isn't always an active online Game of Thrones community, but I missed being steeped in it and wanting to be steeped in it really badly.
We should say right off the bat, we should address the New World Order of, like, last time we recorded in our Season 6 preview, Dave, without having seen a single second of Season 6, other than, you know, the trailers, predicted that Brienne would immediately tell Sansa where Arya was. And the next time on, from this week, reveals that Brienne is going to immediately tell Sansa where Arya is, and that's probably why Brienne goes to Riverlands. So Dave has his first A-plus win of the season with that prediction.
Yeah.
That's like great. You know, like, story and character and stuff really well.
I know, yeah. That's a great review of me. Maybe we should read a review of this show, which is something we do now.
Yeah. So thank you guys all for leaving your reviews. We got so many positive and no negatives reviews on our Storm Spoiler
stream. That sounds like a challenge. Don't do that.
I'm not encouraging people to leave negative reviews.
We have plenty of negatives, don't we?
When they read reviews on the Fighting the War Room podcast, they're mixed, and so it's funny, and David Ehrlich is funny, and I'm just like, oh, let me read compliments about ourselves. But okay, so this one comes from Sansa Fierce, which is a great Twitter handle, iTunes handle.
I feel like we birthed that one.
We might have. And she says,
so connected.
Spoiling at its best. And she says, I can't believe that people, I am assuming it's a she, could be a he. I can't believe that people complain about too many spoilers in a podcast called The Storm Spoilers. I love all the production spoilers, especially because I would miss some of those tidbits without this podcast. I'm a book reader, but I enjoy the perspective of a non-book reader who loves being spoiled. It gives it a unique twist from other podcasts. I enjoy listening to all the hosts and the side trips to the Citadel of Crazy. What is Game of Thrones without the best tinfoil you can find? Keep it up, and please give us all the spoilers and speculation that is available. There are a lot of other podcasts that tiptoe around spoilers. It is so refreshing to listen to a podcast where it all hangs out. And of course, all hail the Queen in the North. So thank you for that, and thank you for all your reviews. We really appreciate it.
It's going to be...
They really nailed it with the it all hangs out comment.
Yeah, no, that's true.
I was also looking for some sort of Hodor dick callback joke, but did not get there fast enough. For
I was thinking a Melisandre moment. I don't know.
I mean,
she let it all hang out this episode.
She did. Sure did. There was a lot to hang out, a lot more than we've seen previously. Most of it was skin.
Yes.
A lot of it was hair, too. But we're getting way ahead of ourselves. We're back at season 6 with the Red Woman, and how we're going to do this season is we've reopened up our Twitter at @StormSpoilers and StormSpoilers@gmail.com for your questions. We got a lot. Some of them are great. No, they're all great. We're going to read some of them later on, but first we're going to go through the episode with our usual fine-tooth comb, hopefully answering some of them along the way. But stay tuned for that afterwards. But until then, you know how it goes. We're back in Westeros. And unlike last season where we, previous seasons where, because there's so much action in like a penultimate episode, the final episode of a season sort of introduces where we're going to be going. This season, I realized at the beginning of season 6, sort of ended on a cliffhanger with a lot of storylines in a way that I immediately needed to see what happened with some people. And I was very pleasantly rewarded in Sansa and Brienne finally meeting up, and then my hopes were horribly dashed with Dorne and the delay of Jon Snow catharsis. I guess we might as well start with Melisandre, because this is what I was alluding to at the very top, which is that apparently book readers saw this coming. Me, Dave, who's never read a point of view chapter from a really old witch, didn't. And, you know, I think I played directly into what the showrunners and the directors and the crew wanted me to do here, which is going into the final scene of the episode and being like, here comes that end for nudity tag with good old Melisandre, like always happens. And then she takes off her ruby, and I basically get transported back to the very beginning of The Witch and realize that I've seen just a lot of naked old women this year.
I immediately thought of The Witch as well.
Yeah,
I think it's great because it's just not. I mean, you know, the director has said that they didn't use probably any I think he said any CGI on that body double's body, and it's just so unusual for us to see a naked woman that's who's that old.
It was face replacement then.
They put prosthetics and a wig on Carice Van Houten, and put her face on this old woman's body.
Mm. Interesting. Mm-hmm. I will say this, Dave, because you mentioned that book readers kind of saw this coming. Personally, I did not. None of it was it wasn't surprising. Like it all started to fit when I heard that this was happening or when I saw it happen. But it's never something that I would have predicted, I think, because all the little breadcrumbs are there. Like the glamour is something that gets used in the books. There's allusions to Melisandre being old, but I think it's actually a really smart thing for the show because it's something that, you know, it makes sense to book readers based on everything we know about that character, but it's not really something I saw coming. Like, it's not something I expected to see in this season, nor did I think it was something that would be potentially vital to Jon Snow coming back. So I thought it was kind of a fun surprise. It's really a good pull by the show.
Do we think it's vital to Jon Snow coming back?
Maybe.
Just her age in general, or is this just a character beat to...
I don't know. You know, Carice Van Houten, I've been like believing all along that Melisandre was going to be the one to bring him back, but she gave an interview to the, I don't know, it was either the Wall Street Journal or the Washington Post, began with a W. Some outlet that begins with a W, where she said she does not bring him back. And I almost believe her, because I think at this point they've gotten so good at telling, like, the truths that sound like lies or whatever, do you know? So I don't feel like she would just lie. I think right now they're all on message of, like, okay, say he's dead, but, you know, don't say he's not coming back. You know, don't lie, but, you know, obscure. And so she said plainly she was not the one to bring him back, and that makes me question whether it's some other thing. I don't think it's warging, but I don't know. It might be something else. The other thing I want to say, the thing I love about this surprise, is that it really shows the way that attention around the show has changed, because Carice Van Houten said herself, like, in the first season, that Melisandre was super old. And, you know, in 2012, she told Access Hollywood. So this has been out there since 2012, where she was just like, oh, yeah, Melisandre's super duper old. And just no one was poring over every single thing that every actor said at that point. And so it just sort of got lost.
Or, I mean, also at that point, at least for me, and as like a non-book reader, like, I don't know what really old means in a fantasy world. I don't know what that's supposed to look like. But, like, I get crone for sure.
Sure, sure. She could have been super old, but not looked any different. Sure. But, and let me walk that back. Not no one, because when I was doing research on the Melisandre is old question, I found a lot of conversation that goes back a long ways. So people
here's a question for you. When did you start doing research on the Melisandre is old question?
I had heard that it was coming in this episode. So
stop being so Varys with me. This is what you were avoiding the last podcast, where I was like, what should I know going forward into this season? And you were like, no comment. Thanks, Joanna. Thanks a lot.
I knew. Yeah, I had heard that this was happening, that this was coming. I'd actually heard it as a rumor a while ago. So when I was told sort of more specifically that it was coming, I wasn't at all surprised. So I don't remember where that rumor originated. But so I was looking up these old Reddit and A World of Ice and Fire, a Wiki of Ice and Fire, all these old threads of people talking about this stuff. And it's really fascinating. They've been mulling this over for years. So this is a fun payoff, and the first of many, I hope, for book speculation. You know, that like, I'm sure we've gotten it in past seasons, but this confirms something that a lot of book readers felt that they had uncovered, and now it's confirmed by the show. What also seems to me to be confirmed in this episode is that the entire Dorne plot of the books is not going to fucking matter at all. I know Neil has a theory. You can't say no. You can say you don't think so. I'm not saying Dorne doesn't matter. I'm not saying Dorne doesn't matter, but I'm saying I don't think any of like the Aegon stuff or the Quentin stuff or the Prince Doran stuff is going to matter. Dorne is a location and Dorne is a potential ally for Daenerys can still matter. But in terms of a lot of that other like Prince Doran's scheme and stuff like that, that's not going to matter, I think. So.
Not as much as we originally thought, having just read the books.
Right.
I would agree. But I have a theory.
I know.
I just want to mention.
I know.
I actually really, but more importantly, want to hear your Melisandre. Don't you have a Melisandre theory?
Oh, well, I should do better about taking notes of like what Reddit thread I read what on. But this is a conversation I dug up somewhere where they were talking about Melisandre. It was in my Melisandre research. And on some deep and some common threads, like 10 pages into some common thread about Melisandre, they were talking about how perhaps she mistook that Stannis was, and they had book evidence to back this up, perhaps she mistook Stannis as Azor Ahai because she saw Dragonstone and assumed that it was that meant Stannis, when it could mean Jon, because he is a Targaryen heir in a way.
And that's where I believe Rhaegar Targaryen Leia. He was the Prince of Dragonstone before the war, before Robert's Rebellion.
Right. So if Jon Snow is his son and heir, the heir to Dragonstone, then if she saw that and she's like, oh, Stannis is the Lord of Dragonstone, so Stannis is Azor Ahai. But if she saw Dragonstone and it really meant Jon Snow, that's a way that, like, you know, because there's a question of like, okay, is Melisandre terrible at visions? And maybe it's not. You know, maybe she just interpreted something she saw. I mean, there's also that weird line.
That still makes you terrible at visions. I mean, to be good at visions, you need to have the vision and interpret the vision.
It makes you mediocre at vision, but it doesn't.
If I learned anything from the Old Testament, the interpreting is just as important as having the visions.
It makes mediocre at best.
I think trying to interpret those visions, though, those visions are really a stand-in for like George R. R. Martin's mind. So trying to figure out what's going on in there half the time is really, really hard. So I don't blame her for having some trouble.
Well, I mean, yeah, if you look at Maggie the Frog's prophecy, right? she's got the, you know, the kid thing is pretty clear, but then there's the whole Valancourt thing. Mm-hmm. There's been other just very right. She had the like, I see a half drowned man, like the drowned crow, like the whole like Balon Greyjoy thing. That's all very oblique. And so Melisandre, mm-hmm. I'm just excusing Melisandre. All I'm saying is that she shouldn't be so hard on herself as she is at the end of this episode, because yeah, she misinterpreted as Davos. So that doesn't mean that her entire belief system is a lie. Right? In theory.
Right. Well, and I mean, we know as the audience that her entire belief system is not a lie.
Right.
Because we know that the only two essentially religions that have shown us any results are the Lord of Light and the Old Gods. You know, the Old Gods are what essentially give the Stark kids their power. So the Brand's warging is an Old Gods thing. And then the Lord of Light has literally resurrected people from the dead in the show and the books. So her god is legit, right. But it's not.
Have the
seven have possibility for her to have doubts?
Have the seven done anything?
No,
other than be
not really
super judgy.
They're pretty. I think
in the books you have. In the books, though, wasn't there a like an old woman on a hill that like speaks to the Brotherhood, who's supposed to be like of the seven? There are, like, I feel like in the books there are elements of real magic that exists for the seven, but it really, none of the other, I can't think of anything substantial that the seven have done other than inspire the Faith Militant.
The last thing I'll say about that Melisandre thing is someone brought up, you know, her as the crone, you know, which is a classic, you know, figure. But the crone is one of the seven gods. So maybe we should be on the lookout for who would fulfill the other roles of the seven. Maybe.
Mm.
Ooh.
Sort of like a Battlestar Galactica thing.
You have a mother of dragons.
Uh-huh.
You have a warrior soon to be resurrected.
Uh-huh.
You have a maiden of House Stark.
Sure.
Who's still kicking. Now, see, that's where it starts to fall apart.
Yeah,
the father thing. I don't have one of those. But I don't know. I think the Lord of Light. I really do think the Ice and Fire are the Lord of Light, and then the Great Other, which is what they believe is the old god behind the White Walkers.
But maybe the seven who are sort of in between the old gods and Rolor are, I don't know, the humanity, the human figures that we'll see at the end of this whole story.
Ooh, I don't interesting. Know.
I also wouldn't mind if the human-made religion is just bullshit. They're like, man-made religion, and it's just bullshit? Good to know.
Yeah, I know. I mean, and that's the whole Sparrows, you know. Yeah.
It's kind of like the whole Battlestar Galactica thing, where it's like polytheism is the one that's wrong, and monotheism ultimately is what is correct.
Could be.
Yeah. Spoilers for Battlestar Galactica.
those were the days. Back when it was a simple one god and
right.
controlling all of the machines, all of his
five final Cylons.
Oh, man. Anyway, so we're keeping the body up at Winterfell with an old crone and Davos, who likes mutton.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, sorry, at the Wall. I said Winterfell. Everybody's moving north towards the Wall from Winterfell, which is something that we're getting to. But is there some reason that they need to not burn the body at the Wall besides that we need it?
The best interpretation it's, you know, as many people have discussed, it feels like a convenient thing rather than an actual organic thing. But the best organic interpretation I can come up with is they moved his body inside to, like, you know, not have it dishonorably freezing out in the courtyard. But then once they were inside, it was just sort of a siege situation where it's not so much they're protecting the body as they're like, okay, this is where we made our camp. And unfortunately, our camp has a dead body in it.
His body.
Right. But now we're screwed.
But
they just got stuck.
We can't burn him inside. So we're just going to deal with it for right now. Yeah.
I guess with that conflict's missing, and whatever happened to make Dorne happen in the series, it did, is sort of like missing from the episode. And I feel like on A Cast of Kings, you read that production note that Prince Doran receives that at least makes sense about where everybody's supposed to be geographically, even if it doesn't make any sense time-wise with the narrative.
Yeah.
I feel like there's
one... I think it makes sense.
Well, I mean, once you know that thing, but it isn't in the actual episode.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think you have to do a lot of explaining. I think there's
to make it make sense. Yeah, right. The show doesn't explain it very well, but it makes sense once you kind of think it through.
Right. So I feel like I should read that thing here just in case someone didn't listen to Cast of Kings, which I think is true of some of our listeners.
Sure.
Let me find this. And it was actually left on our Storm of Spoilers Twitter feed by good old Pat Spinagle, the best podcast listener that ever was.
Pat.
Okay, so this is a production note, a prop from the production. This is what Prince Doran read shortly before being stabbed to death. And it's from Jaime Lannister. I don't think we knew who the letter was from when he read it, the tiny scroll. But it says, "The Princess Myrcella died by poison on a return journey." I mean, what a dry way to talk about your daughter dying. But anyway, "The Princess Myrcella died by poison on a return journey. I suspect Ilaria, not you, but my sister will demand war. I doubt Ilaria's head will appease her, but it's a start, along with your nieces. Your son cannot stay in King's Landing. I'm sending him back on the same ship." So that sort of explains why Trystane is just chilling in the belly of the ship, painting eye rocks.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense because why? I mean, Trystane is in nothing but danger if he gets off that ship. So it makes sense that the ship is docked. They're probably resupplying and getting ready to leave again.
Well, yeah, but it doesn't explain. I mean, Jaime, we don't know this motivation from Jaime. Like, maybe Jaime would want to throw him in a prison cell and see him pay as retribution. You know, we don't know.
I feel like
get that process from Jaime.
Here's the thing that I think everybody's missing. So Jaime would not have known about the poison stuff, but Bronn does. And Bronn was with him. So Bronn probably said, "Hey, by the way, that was totally the Sand Snakes that poisoned your daughter."
But do you see that this all...
Because they tried to poison me earlier.
But do you see this all requires you to write an entire fan fiction, like, to supplement what happened in the show?
It's missing, like, this whole sequence, which is emblematic of the entire Dorne plotline, is missing, like, two good scenes where they explain some shit.
Actually, any good scenes, but two additional scenes. Yes, I agree.
Right.
Let's keep going. I think
the problem is... The problem with Dorne is that they are... Essentially, the efficiency is coming is hurting them because they're rushing to get to what I believe to be an end point for Dorne.
Do you want to talk about that here?
Sure. Yeah. So if we think about the way that Dorne has played out in the show and the way it kind of plays out in the books it is Arryon Martell and the Sand Snakes band together and steal Myrcella. She gets hurt. They end up kind of back with Dorne. He tells all about his Dornish master plan and about how he sent his son to Daenerys and how they're on the Targaryen side and all that good stuff. I think what the show has done is at some point, probably in season four, they decided, okay, Ilaria is a good enough character for us. We don't need Arryon Martell, so we're going to substitute her. So I think if you play out the book story a little bit further, it's not unreasonable to think that once they find out about Quentin's death, Arianne may kind of take the, you know, if Doran doesn't do anything after that, she may take over one way or another from her father. And then it's her and the Sand Snakes and this war against the Lannisters and still trying to align themselves with the Targaryens. So I think what they've done is they've taken Arryon Martell and Ilaria and smashed them together. And they've used this whole revolt because if you think about it, it makes sense. The Dornish people might not be happy with the Lannisters. So if they perceive Doran to be inactive in revenge of Oberyn's death, they may be going along with this plan. It makes more sense for them to go along with Arryon Martell because she's actually
a Martell.
She's actually a Martell. She's actually in line to take the throne, especially once Quentin's dead. But I guess the show decided, okay, Ilaria's enough to make this work.
Right, and I just disagree that Ellara is enough.
Well, yeah, I mean, and I disagree as well.
And the, I mean, if Aegon as a, is a pretender in the books, and they cut that, and then they felt they could just cut all of Doran, like Prince Doran, that's fine. But then you do have, as people have pointed out, like just a boring character in Prince Doran, when instead he was like this interesting layered character. And so all you have now in Doran is cardboard. You've got this passive prince who just wants to shuffle around his gardens, and you've got these hot-blooded women who are all like go go go, and there's no nuance or in between. When in the books, even if the whole Doran thing is kind of a stall, which I think it might be, at least there are shades and nuance there. And as you say, efficiency is coming, and we have to get where we have to get. The other Doran thing that I want to mention, and this is a production spoiler, is that I believe, well, I know that Lady Olenna, Diana Rigg, and Conlathil Varys were spotted filming in Dorne.
Yeah, so, so that makes sense.
If the Tyrells are coming, if the Tyrells are coming to Dorne, if Varys is coming to Dorne, if Daenerys lands there and she's got the Tyrells who hate the Lannisters, and she's got Dorne who hate the Lannisters, and she's got Varys, who's in favor of the Targaryen restoration. Then she's got some mighty allies to take down King's Landing.
So. And I think that's always been the way I've in my mind it's played out in the books. And I always thought it was going to be Arianne Martell who would lead that charge. Because Doran is passive. I think ultimately the show just kind of painted themselves into a corner last year by making him such a terrible character in the show. So this is really them going, oh shit, we need to fix this like right now. And the best thing they have, instead of introducing a whole other character, is, oh, let's just have Ellaria, you know, lead an uprising against the prince, which it's not great, but at least gets you there.
I'm just going to say right now that every time the show, not every time, I'm sure someone can write in and give me an example otherwise, a lot of the times that the show has decided to have one character stand in for another, like Jamie going to Dorne, like Ollie, like Roz, these like show invented composite characters, or Sansa, these show transplanted characters for efficiency's sake. It really has not worked out very well for me as a
It lacks a nuance, which is something the books have a lot more room to do.
And I wanted to ask Dave a question, which is that a lot of book readers have written into me this week to say that one of their biggest fears of the show going off book is not, oh, that they'll be spoiled or whatever, but that it will lose just some of like the wit and the skill that Martin's source material brought, that a lot of the quotable lines from the show are lifted directly from the books. And now Weiss and Benioff and Cogman and Hill, et cetera, are having to construct these themselves, and they're not quite as masterful because George Martin takes a decade to write a book and has time to whip up some things. My question for Dave is, do you feel like there's a demonstrable difference in the dialogue in this episode versus past seasons?
I think there's a demonstrable difference in what we're intended to care about, or at least what the eye of the show is supposed to care about. Being a man, I can't tell for certain if it's male gaze versus slightly less male gaze, but that's certainly, I don't know, that's beginning, it's beginning to be what it feels like. This TV show has had the backbone of the books for so long that I'm not exactly sure what its pure voice is, and if this episode is, I guess, a forecast of what's to come, I am not looking forward to just being bashed over the head with things. From characters that, you know, we've spent five seasons with, so I could accept a little bit of nuance from them. And so, like, I'm really, like, pleased by moments that, like, Sophie Turner is able to communicate things besides cold without having any dialogue. But then there's stuff like Jorah and Dario talking about who cares.
Oh, so bad.
And, like, setting up stakes of my least favorite trope in television storytelling, which is the willful withholding of dangerous information.
I know.
So, like,
I love when people do that, and I know you're watching, Dave.
Sir Jorah, like, of House Droid.
Yeah.
I'm like, Dave is so mad right now that Jorah just won't tell everyone that he is Grayscale.
It's like they would put up with him. He's Jorah. Like, it's they've already tried to throw him out for every other goddamn reason. And that, right. And then also the Dothraki stuff, I'm really, like, that paired with the ships being lit on fire in Marine, it's just like Danny's like, get an army, get some ships, but in getting some ships, lose the army, and then we got to get all the dragons back together. It's like dragons, ships, army, like that shouldn't be that hard.
Well, the way
my patience has run out.
Oh, the way I see this episode is pointing players in certain directions. So we see, I mean, the next time on does this, but we see Brienne pointed down south to the Riverlands, right? If she talks about Arya and Sansa says, I mean, I think Brienne and Sansa are going to part ways as soon as next week's episode, which is like Tyrion and Daenerys being together for like two episodes. But
hey, here's that cool thing you guys wanted.
Yeah.
Now we're taking it away.
Bye-bye. But this also, Daenerys's ships catching on fire, right, points the Greyjoys towards Marine because they've got this huge fleet. So if Asha Greyjoy ends up going over there with all her boats, then that will give Daenerys the fleet she needs. So that sort of points.
Who's Asha Greyjoy?
Oh, Yara.
That's Yara? Right. It's Yara Greyjoy. Oh,
sorry. Thank you.
Hey, can I? Can I answer your question from before about the
dialogue?
The dialogue, yes. Yeah. Because I think on a micro level, Weiss and Benioff, as specifically as screenwriters, have the wit. Like, I thought this episode was significantly funnier than I expected it to be. So I think that they can deliver that stuff. Like, they get some of these characters, like Ser Davos, really well.
Yeah.
I worry about the larger, the macro stuff. I worry about them devising whole storylines that are created for efficiency or created out of nowhere. It's really the big stuff, which I think is more the team of writers. But I really do feel like Weiss and Benioff, when they write an episode, they get the dialogue pretty close to what George R. R. Martin does. It's not the same, but it's close.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I mean, it's just not playing to the things that I like about the series, which is like crazy medieval politics and like people playing long-term power games. This latter Game of Thrones era seems to be about, you know, bringing things to a close by delivering the big moments. And if those are ham-fisted and therefore don't have the stilts to rise them up, they're just, it's going to feel gross. It's going to feel gross on the inside. I don't want that.
We don't want you to feel gross, Dan.
That's right. I don't want to feel gross either.
Oh. Take off your gem necklace.
Yeah, and take a nap.
Just let it all out.
Let it all hang out.
Feel gross on the outside too.
Not gross, just old.
Oh, sorry. Old. I don't want to get accused of ageism.
That is the thing, and I've said this elsewhere. I really like that Weiss and Benioff in the post-episode interview and Jeremy Podeswa in the Entertainment Weekly interview all used adjectives like weak, vulnerable, feeble, all this stuff, and not ew, gross. And the ew, gross reaction just really bothered me for some reason. Because lucky enough to get that old, well, you're not going to get 400 years old. But if you're all lucky to get as old as that actress, you're going to look like that. So deal with it. That's
right.
My opinion. I don't know. And my boobs aren't going to fall important. That low.
I've never seen you wear a supportive bra, Dave, so I don't know.
I think the important thing, and I think plenty of people have expressed this, is that the show didn't do that to be gross. The show did that because that's an important character moment. It's an important, the show. I don't think that of all the things that I've accused the show of using to shock us, I honestly don't think this is one of them, because it's more about informing us about that character than it is about showing us an old woman's naked body. So, I don't have a problem with it at all.
I mean, I don't either. And if any of my reactions were negative body shaming to old people, I don't think they were, but I was, in a flurry of emotion on Sunday on Twitter. So I apologize for that.
The
same way, like when you first see Lemonade, you're like, is she breaking up with Jay-Z? And then it's like, go beyond autobiography, Dave. It's a piece of art. So like everybody had an emotional weekend with HBO, and we're all coming to terms with that.
HBO had a really good weekend.
I think it did.
That's the takeaway here, is that it had a really exciting HBO weekend.
it saw all the think pieces about like, is HBO's relevancy over? And it's like, you know what? No.
Apparently.
But ow. It's
like, oh, you didn't like vinyl? Here's all this.
But ow. All right.
All right, where we went off track because are we done pooping on Dorne? I feel like we did it, but I also feel like this is sort of the end of a lot of possibilities.
The only other thing I have to say about Dorne is that I don't think this is the last we're going to see of it.
No, I don't.
But I think that it's probably gone until very late in the season.
I hope so. I don't know what the hell the Sand Snakes are doing in King's Landing.
That is one fun thing.
A bunch of people have asked if, you know, because Kevin Lannister dies, Pycelle dies, right? And the question is, are the Sand Snakes going to be the one to kill them? I don't know why they would attack Pycelle and Kevin and not Cersei.
I mean, Kevin is a Lannister.
Yeah, but why would you go for an obscure Lannister when you could go for the most famous Lannister?
Don't they need somebody there to eventually tell the Martells that they're up for an alliance? And aren't the Martells going to show up there to reclaim their...
Well, there are no Martells.
Marjorie Tyrells. There we go.
Maybe.
But they're like, that's another thing, that the show has now killed off the Baratheon line and the Martell line. Snuffed it, right?
Tommen's a Baratheon. Well, I dare you to tell me otherwise. What's his name?
I don't know. He's namely.
And he's going to die. He's going to die soon,
too. Well, I do think I prefer the Sand Snakes. If we're going to keep with Dorne, and we're going to keep with the Sand Snakes around, I prefer them kind of spread out. Two and one is fine. And I do prefer them more as like the Oberyn-style disruptors. But I don't see what they can disrupt at this point. So I think that's kind of a weird problem. So I think maybe they go away for a while.
So what's the crazy Dornish plan that's very slowly in motion? If you could break it down. That we're not going to see that's in the books?
It's essentially aligning with the Targaryens. So, like, Doran sends his son to go treat with Daenerys and woo her and forge an alliance between the Martells and the Targaryens and be kind of the force on the ground in Westeros for Daenerys. And Quentin goes to Meereen and gets barbecued by the dragons because he thinks he can ride one, and he's wrong.
And we're gonna see Tyrion and the dragons next week.
Yeah.
So it's possible the Tyrells and Ilaria could unite Dorne and Highgarden just by hatred of the Lannisters.
Oh, sure.
It's true, but like Ilaria is just not a planner. Like that's the thing is like to put her in a strategy position is so frustrating to me because
I feel like it'll have to be a plan that is brought to her.
Yeah, and she'll be like. Okay, here's some spears. Or like,
okay, you want to kill the Lannisters?
So.
I mean, yeah, I guess you're right. There's a hole in the Ilaria story where her and Oberyn are traveling around having sex with lots of people that they could maybe plan some stuff, but I don't think that she's smart enough.
She's just been running hot on emotion for ever since Oberyn got his head popped.
But now she's leading a little city state, so she's got to do something.
She's leading a huge portion of the country at this point. Okay. And I think that's made clear by the guards not doing anything. It's like, oh, everybody's kind of in on this.
I mean, that's just crazy. It's insane that a huge chunk of Westeros is now being led by, I'm sorry, a bastard. Like, and I know in Dorne, they do not shim bastards or like whatever, but like you know, it's the bastard mistress of one of their dead princes.
Mm-hmm. She's a paramour.
Like, that's crazy. That's stupid. And it happened like in the stupidest coup I've ever seen in my entire life.
Yay, Game of Thrones feminism.
Yay, girls.
Girl power, yay. This is the Game of Thrones heavy-handed version of, hey, we could do girl power. Look at this.
Oh, you think our show's not feminist? We can write some ham-fisted dialogue that says otherwise.
You don't like rape, eh? We'll give you this instead.
Anyway.
All right, so we've done Dorne. We've talked about the Wall.
Yeah. We could talk, I guess, a little bit about the North, just because it's so satisfying, and now is a good time to bring up that Brienne totally had to kill those dogs. Like, I don't know if we didn't see it or not, but just logistically, you don't... Hunting hounds aren't like, oh shit, run away.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, is like, a bunch of people are like, where'd those dogs go? And I was like, you know where they went? They went where we could still root for Brienne.
Yep.
So we didn't have to watch her, like, she and Pod spear a bunch of hounds. Yeah, that's a whole...
I mean,
that's
I bet they were kicked to death by the horses, because dogs, you know, they got a good idea, but...
Or maybe Reek killed ideas. Them.
No, because he used to sleep with them. You feel like he would have been like...
Oh, yeah. Also, can
he's
I
like,
mention...
my mates. I can't do you dirty.
Yeah.
Wow. Can I mention the most disturbing part of the whole episode? Is not that Ramsay said, feed Miranda to the hounds. It's that Miranda's father is the kennel master for the Boltons. So basically... they probably had to take Miranda's body to her father, and he had to cut her up and feed her to his dogs.
That's presuming he's still the kennel master for the Boltons, but yes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
If he's still alive and is the kennel master, that's an extra layer of fucked up.
Extremely fucked up, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like, beyond just feeding her body to the dogs, which I guess is just efficiency of, like, not wasting meat.
Yeah, waste not want not, Neil.
But, man, that's dark. So... anyway, but hooray for Brienne. She finally did what everyone thought she was going to do.
Yeah, and it was great.
She was going to do.
And they treated sword fighting like things weighed things, which I love every time it happens. And Gwendolyn Christie is exceedingly good at. I love that she's a badass fighter.
She's good at looking like she's like, it's hard.
Yeah. It's not
you
effortless.
Get from all of the Brienne's fight scenes that, oh my God, this looks really hard. It's not like... you know, the Princess Bride, where they both look like it's super easy.
Yeah,
did we like this fight scene then?
Did you not like this fight scene?
Well, my question is, because it was directed by Jeremy Podesel, right, who did Unbound, Unbent, Unbroken, the Sand Snake fight. So has he gotten better at shooting fight
I mean, the geography is all over the place and it's horrible. Like, Reek standing there with a sword for like a minute while Pod's like fighting things off. So, like, it's not a good... I'm not going to, like, teach this in classes or anything, but because this is what I wanted to see happen for so long, I was very forgiving of the way it went down.
As opposed to the Sand Snake fight, what he really accomplished here is getting to the emotional stakes of the fight, which is something that TV doesn't always get right. And they got very wrong with the Sand Snakes thing. So I think... I feel like it was kind of served up to him on a platter. It was like, well, Brienne's going to save the day. So even if you mess this up, it's still going to be kind of cool.
And it was.
It was. That was my favorite moment. I've watched it several times and cried every single time. Like teared up, not wept openly.
It's very charming. Sansa's, you know, because you would think she's kind of learned. She really has the most earned storyline. In the sense of her becoming a power, I think. So her rise that we may see in this season is going to feel great. I don't like how we got here necessarily. I think they didn't have to go all the way down.
I agree.
But it is going to feel great. And I think this is a perfect like little step. And this whole season is really going to be about her kind of coming into her own as the person in charge for the Stark family. She is the eldest Stark left. And I really like that little moment where she's kind of struggles through it, but she gets it that these are the kind of people I need around me.
Yeah. And as I mentioned in Cast of Kings, this is a very similar, almost identical vow that Catelyn and Brienne swore to each other a couple seasons ago. So that was a nice sort of reference. We like seeing Sansa grow into her mom, even though things didn't work out for her mom. And I mean, that's kind of a theme of the season because we've already seen Cersei brought super low. So as I've mentioned before, I think watching her take vengeance, at least on the Sparrows, is going to be entertaining to me. And we're in the process of watching Arya get broken all the way down. So then when Arya climbs out of whatever hole she's going into, you know, it's going to feel satisfying. And Jon is going to come back from the dead. And that, I mean, it's hard to remember that a couple seasons ago, we did not like Jon Snow. A lot of people did not like Jon Snow.
I didn't really like Sansa for the first couple
seasons. Yeah, yeah. Did not like Sophie Turner or Kit Harington's performances. Did not think those characters were that interesting.
I still don't like Bran.
Well, you haven't seen, he might have been taking acting classes for a year. You don't know. I actually think Bran stuff is going to be pretty cool this season. But like, yeah, so to take these characters that weren't working super well, break them down, and build them back up is interesting. But it is kind of a classic hero's journey versus what the first half of Game of Thrones was, which was subverting the hero's journey, right? Like, all these, you know, oh, Rob's the hero, oh, Ned's the hero, Cass the hero, and then cutting them down. With the remaining characters, it's abusing them, but then letting them rise back up.
I think that's an important, like, thematic thing to consider as we get to the end. I mean, we're down to the last third of this entire story. I think, and I had this discussion on Twitter with a couple of people about nihilism and whether this show fits into that, which I don't think is true. But I do think that George R. R. Martin had a lot of fun subverting our expectations of the fantasy genre. But I also think he's too big of a fantasy nerd not to eventually get around to that classic heroes winning the day thing. I don't know if it's, I think it's going to be messier than, you know, most fantasy stories, but I think he loves the genre too much to totally go against it all the way to the end.
Yeah. That sounds reasonable to me. I mean, I don't think it's like, I think last season I might've made this argument on the show where it's like, I kind of like a medieval show that's medieval fantasy show that's being nihilist almost because I've been, you know, absorbed with. And so it is that counter intuitive thing that George R. R. Martin loves to do, starting with Ned Stark. Yeah. Nice one, Dave. Ed Stark. You guys can leave me a one star review for that one. I earned it.
Well, he's Eddard.
Eddard, you know? Yeah. It would sort of work.
Could have been Eddie in a different.
He definitely could have been Ed. Yeah.
Okay. Three star review. but I more would like to see like a climax that happens much sooner than I expect it in this story. A traditional fantasy climax, and then like some sort of ellipsis more in the Tolkien line, maybe not as long, but you know, if it needs to be a 6-episode mini season ellipsis, I'd be down for that too.
Do you mean the like the Shire stuff or the Greyhaven stuff?
Well, just like I mean both, but just like something else where it's like our huge, you know, ice zombies versus dragon thing,
right? What happens after the war,
right? I would rather have it be like, yeah, the previous seasons where our penultimate, you know, thing gives way into a and afterwards, you know, leaving you with a little bit of what the world's going to be afterwards, than just like ends with, you know, I don't know, Daenerys walking into a burnt out Iron Throne room and like sits down and we cut to black.
I do like the notion, and I've been thinking about this a lot, about the Jon Snow thing, you know, as I form my larger theories about the end of this show being all about subverting the patriarchy. But I do like the idea of Jon Snow coming back and then not being alive for much longer. I'm not saying like dying again this season, but I'm saying at some point sacrificing himself, you know, in a way that allows the society to move on, you know, in the great war against the White Walkers. I think that would be kind of an interesting way to.
And then he made himself a wall and pushed himself north.
But you know, he comes back only long enough to defeat the Night's King or something, and then there's like a whole nother 7 episodes of figuring out what the hell's going to go.
Yeah, I like John Nami. I mean, I really wanted Harry Potter to die too, so I like John Nami.
You got your wish.
Yeah, he came back just like Jon Snow.
Did he?
He always comes back.
I mean, come back full. Stay tuned, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child.
Who do you think made a family with Ginny? Are you saying Ginny's been like married to some, I don't know, wraith?
I'm saying all the prophecies.
That, are you saying it came back wrong?
Like,
spoiler alert for Harry Potter.
Rowling's prophecies are obliquely enough written that who knows what really happened, right?
Right. It could be Dragonstone. It could be Stannis. It could be Jon. I'm just saying. All right. What are we missing?
What are we missing?
We didn't talk about...
What's going to happen? Go ahead. What's going to happen with Theon? Because we didn't really project him into season 6. Because I guess I assume that he would die at some point around here. But he's he looks like he's going to be Team Sansa.
He's going to the Iron Islands. He's going home, which is interesting because next week's episode is called Home, and I've been trying to figure out what that belongs to, what the word home belongs to in that episode. Like the description's been out, and if Theon goes home in this episode, it could be something. Mm. But, you know, I mean, like, if Bran and Pod are leaving Sansa, I don't know, do they have to get to the wall first and then Bran and Pod leave? Or, you know, get Sansa to the wall, to Davos, then she's got another adult supervision and Bran and Pod can leave. But at what point does Theon leave her?
And at what point do they outpace the Bolton group that's also going to the wall?
Mm.
Well, they're at least ahead of the Boltons, though they're not on horseback necessarily. But
they have horses.
Bran and Pod have horses. What about Sansa and Theon?
Pretty sure they could put them on the horses as well.
I guess that's true.
Put two people on a horse.
That's true. Ramsay, I think, is going to House Umber to get himself a Rickon. It says in episode 3 that Ramsay gets a gift, and I believe that that's Rickon Stark.
Maybe he also sends a letter to the wall about how he's got Rickon Stark.
A pink letter, perhaps?
Mm, yeah, some sort of rouge-esque shade letter.
That's a book thing, if you guys are listening and haven't read the books. Ramsay's pink letter. I think... Ramsay's not making it to the wall. I think Ramsay's going to stop at House Umber on the way to the wall and get the Stark heir that he needs rather than go after Sansa.
Well, he can't have a... Okay, the North isn't...
Well, no, he's going to use... the idea would be he would use Rickon as bait to get Sansa back.
Oh, yeah.
Like, I'm going to kill boy if you don't give me the girl back.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's not going to work.
When Joanna said, like, has their Stark, I'm like, that would not work. I know how babies are made.
No, that's true. But, I mean, like, having a Stark is better than having no Starks. Having a baby-making Stark is the best Stark, but having any Stark is a good Stark. But you're right.
You can threaten to flay any Stark.
Having Rickon is a good start. I don't know how they're going to prove that they have Rickon. Like, are they going to send little crushed walnuts in the envelope with the letter?
Are they going to send a piece of Rickon?
Because how you identify it? Does he have a Dornish birthmark just like Loras? Like, there have been fake Bran and Rickons before, so I don't know how they're going to prove.
And that's kind of the essence of the... first of all, Sansa knows that they're alive, so she'll believe it. But kind of the essence of the pink letter is that Ramsay's totally bluffing, because when he sends the pink letter, he doesn't have Sansa, but he says he has Arya, but he doesn't, because they make it out to be Arya that marries Ramsay, the fake girl, right?
Right.
So it's a lie anyway. So I think the show's just trading one lie for another.
We'll see what happens with Rickon. But I believe Rickon is the gift. We also all think that Ramsay's going to murder the shit out of his dad and his pregnant stepmom.
Oh, that'd be so much fun.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
Poor Roose. I like Roose. I think he's interesting.
I love Roose, man.
I love that actor. His voice is just phenomenal.
Yeah.
I was half on Roose's side in the Red Wedding, just for the shade he throws in the one look when she peels back and sees the, like, and he's like, you should have seen this coming.
Smirk, smirk, smirk.
Stupid you coming here, sitting down at this man's table.
But, yeah, and in this episode, it's great, too. He's like, you played your game with the Stark girl. You played your games with the heir of the Iron Islands, and now they're gone, you motherfucker. Like, he's right. Team Roose.
Yep. Roose's last words are going to be something very disappointed in himself.
Well, yeah, the biggest problem with Roose is that he hasn't killed Ramsay yet, I think.
Right.
Because having Ramsay around is just not smart business, and I like it when Roose is smart, you know?
Okay, what else did we I guess only need to talk more about Daenerys, maybe? I mean, we're just waiting for Drogon to show up wherever they take her, right?
I'm not, right.
I'm not missing some other.
It's Daenerys' thing. It's another example for playing the quiet game, which I think is a fun thing. You know, she did that with the guy in Astapor, where she kind of played like she didn't know the language, and then was a badass for a couple minutes. I didn't like the kind of catcalling they were doing to her. I mean, that was, you know, but it sets up how they're just Dothraki bros.
But see, that's what I'm saying is like you I don't see
like you didn't need to
I don't
do that.
See the wit that you see in Weiss and Benioff.
I did find the wit in the tent scene when the other two Dothraki were telling him what was better than seeing a naked woman, beautiful woman naked for the first time. That was funny.
What is best in life? To crush your enemies.
What is best in life? And they come up with like four things.
To see them running like, before you.
He's like, fine, it's in the top five.
Yeah.
Which I feel like it's a very modern style argument.
I just
don't really fit.
I don't love these new Dothraki as much as I enjoy.
I don't think they're going to be around for very long.
Well,
no, maybe. I don't think they're going to be bad guys for very long.
No, Drogon's going to come, torch the shit out of, I don't know, the
Vice
temple.
Dothrak?
Well, the temple where the Dushkaleen are, maybe. And
now like, there are no widows for me to camp with.
I am the only widow.
Just burn all the widows.
She can add Widow of Widows to all of her titles.
She's going to burn one call, at least, I believe. It's not one we've met in this episode. Because there's like a spare Dothraki. I did a really comprehensive Dothraki rundown.
Oh, yeah. I
and there's a couple missing.
Through it, I guess you could say.
There's a couple missing from this scene. So I think we're going to meet a couple more in Vice Dothrak who are going to be like, oop. Like, these are kind of bro-y bad guys. They just joked about rape. I think these other calls are going to be dead serious about rape, and they're going to get burnt to a crisp.
Because hashtag GOT feminism.
That's right. And so then I think Dany is going to absorb these, what did someone call them? Brothraki into her team.
The Doushraki.
The Doushraki.
I forget who said it.
But yeah, so yeah, I think that maybe Khal Morrow, who's the main Khal, is going to be around. Mm-hmm. The thing that I'm worried about is that Daario is not going to make it out of this rescue mission alive.
Dun, 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 dun.
You don't think Dario's going to make it out?
Oh, sorry, Jorah.
Oh, Jorah. I was like, oh, man, that's a new one.
I'm fine with that.
I
think Jorah's going to lay down the old life for his lady.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, he should have done that by now. And second of all, I'm fine with that now. Because, like, his character arc has gone there and back.
What if grayscale prevents you from being burned by a dragon?
That's a theory. That's actually a theory someone has.
What if Jorah puts up his arm and it doesn't burn?
People were talking about that last year. That, like, maybe Jorah wouldn't burn because he had grayscale. I forget why. Yeah. I think Daario and Jorah are coming for Daenerys. The episode 3, I don't know how much you guys like me getting like real micro with my when I think things are happening, but Daenerys, it says Daenerys meets her future. Bran meets his past, so we think Tower of Joy is in episode 3. Daenerys meets her future, which I think is referring to the Dushkaleen, like her potential future, right? So I think...
Wait, they've already released the thing for episode 3?
Yeah. So I think Drogon is showing up in episode 4, would be my guess.
Another episode for Danny Byrne.
Danny Torch, yeah. So, yeah.
Sweet. All right, let's move on to some user questions. Users. Oh, man, I'm just not batting 1,000 today.
I have some rapid... some of these are pretty rapid fire.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if you want to take... You want to take this part, Neil? You did all our curating. Thank you for that.
Yeah, I've gone through all these. So, the first one from one of my favorite... Twitter handles is @deploy_catattack. wants to know what was our favorite kind of comedic moment? The mutton for Davos, the babies for Tyrion, or feeding Miranda to the hounds? If you had to choose one of the three.
Miranda, yeah. That was a well tossed off line.
I really like the Tyrion one. I thought it was because they're really kind of playing with this whole Tyrion doesn't know High Valyrian very well thing. So it was pretty good.
I'm going to go mutton for
Dave,
Davos.
Do you have a favorite? Oh, all right.
Because, you know, I love just Davos' dry wit, especially since Stannis' dry wit is going to be missing for the season.
This one's more of a statement than a question. I just thought I'd share it. It's from Fernando at Fern Borrego. He says, according to tonight's episode, Jon Snow's last words should have been, "I order you not to stab me," because of how Alistair Thorne says he's always followed orders. So,
stupid Ollie and his stupid look of pride next to the stupid table.
Yep. Let's see. This is an interesting one. I think, Joanna, you could probably put this one to bed pretty easily. Was the this is from at Doublets and Dragons. Was that old scene with Melisandre in the bath and no necklace a continuity error or proof that the glamour is more complex than that?
I think there are three options. I think the most likely is continuity error. I think the second option, I think a lot of people have pointed out that the camera lingers on the potion bottles in that bathroom scene, and then you see a potion bottle again in the end of this episode. So it's possible that it's some sort of hybrid of potions and necklace is what is involved with her glamoring. But it just seems like too, I think some people give this show too much credit. It's rarely ever that nuanced, right? Mm-hmm. The third option is something that some very assiduous redditors came up with, which is that in that scene with Celice in the bathtub, that Melisandre is actually in crone shape, but since Celice is a true believer, if you rewatch it and you look at the it's Tara Fitzgerald, right? If you look at Tara Fitzgerald's reactions, her face, it's possible that she's looking at something that is not a hot young lady, but is in fact the crone body, and Melisandre talks a lot about the flesh and its use. So that's one interpretation, is that she was actually in crone shape in that scene. We just didn't see it. But she tells Celice she doesn't need to use tricks on true believers like Celice. So it's a way you could interpret that scene. I really do think it was probably just a continuity error. So,
because at that point when they were doing season two, they weren't sure they were going to get this far.
I think it was actually season four.
Wait, was that season four?
Yeah.
I think so. I think it was four.
Never mind.
Seven. Anyway, not.
Yeah.
Disregard.
It was season four.
Wait, it seems weird. They have the necklace scene where she gets poisoned and it does sort of like flash. It would just seem weird for me for them to have the foresight to do that, but not have the foresight to keep it on in the bathtub. Mm-hmm.
I like the explanation that Stannis' wife can see her. It's more in line with the book character of Stannis' wife being like the true hardcore believer. But they don't explain it very well, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay, next question is from at Joris V. DeHugan. And this is a great question, and it's answered by an email that we also received from a different person. So just going to roll right through this. His question is, how did the two sand snakes that were on the dock at the end of season 5 get on the boat all the way to King's Landing with Trystane and Jaime? And then we received an email from Jay from RVA, who asked us a very long question about Martin's dialogue, which we already talked about. But in his PS, he said, did you know that the sand snakes possess magical sea turtles that can speed them over to King's Landing in the matter of a day? I missed that detail in A World of Ice and Fire. So there's your answer. Magical sea turtles.
Yeah, it could join Littlefinger's gigantic mockingbird and the fastest ways to travel Westeros.
I mean, I'd buy that if Obara and Nymeria got on the very next boat out of Dorne. They could have, you know, who knows how long Trystane was moldering in that harbor. Like, they could have gotten there. But it's just, as we said before, missing a scene or two. Missing something.
Can you imagine how many times Gendry has rode around the world at this point with that average speed?
He's like, I've seen stone men. I've seen it all, guys.
You guys, I found this cool horn. And I don't know what it does.
quick blow on it. See what happens. Okay. So, and then a couple of our emails, which we always appreciate, were a lot of Jon Snow theories, Three Heads of the Dragon theories. We're going to actually save those for later because I have a feeling that's going to come up a lot. But I did want to get to one email from Ash, who asks, so are the Sparrows going to kill Loras? They have to kill Loras, right? They say, I feel like making him the heir to Highgarden has so many knocks on effects, forgetting how much worse of a character he is, because he's not the heir to Highgarden in the books, that it's just easier to kill him. And Plus, if they make him repent his sins, that enters into an even weirder territory than the one the Sparrows already occupy. How do you see the Loras character going in this season?
I think the Loras function primarily is for Marjorie to work her long con on the Sparrows. Like, for Marjorie to have sufficient motivation to do whatever it takes to get her out of there. Because she seems just... in this episode, and then I think we saw a promotional still from the season where they're like grimily embracing, she seems primarily concerned with her brother and his welfare. So if she needs to lie to the Sparrows to tell them, or maybe they kill Loras, then that's like also a motivator. But, you know, as it's a reverse Sansa. Loras exists as a motivator for Marjorie one way or another, not as his own character. And if they kill him, then what is he going to do, Dave?
Go to Kunlun and learn the magical art of the Iron Fists.
That is right.
That's what I was going to ask Dave. I'm like, do they have to kill him in order for him to be Iron Fist?
I don't think that Highgarden's going to have a big enough place in the overall final war that we need to have Loras sitting around. So if they want to kill him off so he can go be Iron Fist, I'm fine with that just from a watcher standpoint.
I wonder if that's why they've made Yara gayish in this season. If they're going to kill their second gay character.
They
can't kill all the gay characters at once. So, yeah. No, we have one, guys. And it's a lesbian. It's great.
We have the one, and then we have Brienne, which we don't, you know, she's just tall.
Brienne loves Renly and Jaime. She's not a lesbian.
Okay.
She's butch. She's not a lesbian.
Right. That's what I mean.
Oh, okay. sorry, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, she's butch.
Yeah, she is.
Anyway, that I think is all we probably have time. Do we have time for more of these?
We have time for maybe one more if we want to go for it.
Will the burning of Marine's fleet lay the groundwork for Dany accepting Yara's help? Yes, I think we already talked about that. Here's an interesting weird theory that I kind of like, but I don't think the show's going to do this. What if, and this comes from @DJMiller, no relation. What if Melisandre's necklace is the key to her immortality, and the deaths of both Stannis and Jon have made her doubt her faith? She removes the necklace knowing she'll die. Her body is discovered, and somehow Davos makes the connection between Melisandre's immortality and necklace. Davos puts the necklace on Jon, and he's back. I feel like production stills have already kind of debunked this idea, because we see Melisandre back in her normal body elsewhere. So...
It's
kind of a weird theory. Like, does she die to bring him back?
There's an official, there's an official still of her in the courtyard of Castle Black where they clearly cut Sophie Turner out of frame because the hem of her cloak is in the frame, the bottom left. Guys, this is all I do in the off season is look at this stuff. So we know that Sansa and Melisandre are going to get on their horses and ride somewhere at some point. That's going to happen. So
probably next to Jon, who's just outside the frame.
Probably Jon is also there, possibly, or maybe it's Davos. We don't know. But I'm coming around to the theory that Melisandre has nothing to do with Jon Snow coming back. I could be wrong, but that's where I am this week. And I really think he's, like, a lot of people have asked if they're going to put the necklace on Jon, and I just can't see Kit Harington wearing that necklace all season.
Do you think it might be a Bran thing? Like an old gods wirewood tree? Like maybe they go out to burn him by a wirewood tree and he just wakes back up or something?
I don't know, honestly. Ooh,
or I have an idea. Okay, okay, here we go. I had to get at least one good theory in.
Yeah, yeah.
So Melisandre, she knows that the way that Beric Dondarrion was brought back is that Thoros just prayed real hard. That's all he did. So I think maybe what happens is maybe she says the same kind of prayer above Jon's body and nothing happens. So they're like, okay, we have to leave now. Like, and they're just like, all right, let's go. We'll go with Sansa. We'll help her do her thing. We got to get behind a Stark. And then like 10 minutes later, Jon wakes up.
Yeah, I really do support this theory that Sansa and Davos leave before Jon wakes up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Dave, do you have any wild theories you want to throw out there?
Oh, about how Jon comes back?
Yeah.
I think that everything's on the table. We've just, I have my mind so in Azor Ahai reborn that the Melisandre made the most sense. But if we're talking about like people that are going to be at the wall by the time this happens, like all the wildlings are probably going to be there. Bran might be there. Sansa and Davos are going to be there. Melisandre's going to be there. So like literally everything's in play. So I guess not one thing is not more obvious than the other to me right now.
Someone tweeted at us that they were convinced since, you know, Melisandre revealed her glamour, they were convinced that Tormund was going to be unveiled as actually being Mance Rayder at this point. And I just like, I applaud all tinfoil, but I just think that the show has blown past
Tormund, that like, ruby network necklace you've never noticed before.
Under that ginger beard, it would hide it perfectly.
Oh, that's a good point.
But,
well, we know he doesn't shave his beard because he was at the premiere with a big beard, so.
I'm curious.
Christopher Highview, Hair Watch 2016.
I'm curious from our listeners, if you could come up with a great theory of how Jon Snow comes back that has nothing to do with Melisandre or worrying. I really don't think it's working. I just don't think it's working. So I could be wrong.
What about Thoros? He's still alive somewhere.
Yeah, but he's
traipsing around the Riverlands with Lady Stoneheart.
Oh, you guys all assume that. I'm just saying.
the one thing that could support the warging, which I think would be crazy, but it could support it, is and please write in and tell me if I'm wrong. But one of our listeners said that Ghost had not made a sound in the show before Jon Snow died. That you never heard Ghost howling. And now Ghost is howling and snarling. So I don't know if that's true.
That opening shot, I took that as it wasn't Ghost that was howling, that it was other wolves elsewhere howling. Like it was the wolf pack was out there howling because one of the Starks had died.
I think it's...
Because then they show Ghost and he's like just trying to get out of his cage.
Okay. All right. I disagree, I think it's an option.
Yeah. I don't remember season two well enough to know if we never heard Ghost make a sound before.
Yeah. Everything is in play, as Dave says.
Let me know if you, the listener, have heard Ghost make a sound before this episode. So, yeah, I mean, working theoretically back on the table, it's something we have seen on the show. So, yeah, it's an option. There's also that shot in the trailer of what looks like, Neil pointed out, what looks like Davos standing over a pyre. Or Jon Snow's body out on a cliff. So, like, maybe Davos gets to the point where he's going to burn Jon Snow's body.
Right. And I originally wrote it off as, like, oh, maybe he goes and burns Stannis' body. But I think that ship has sailed.
Yeah. It's all very curious. I mean, it's kind of fun. We don't know, man. We don't know. We know he's coming back. We do not know how. So
now we know where the lie line is. It's still Jon Snow is dead for good. Thanks, Entertainment Weekly. And that has been season 6, episode 1 of Storm of Spoilers. Guys, where can people catch up with you online? Let's start with Neil this week because he's got some stuff.
Lots of stuff. You can catch some of my articles on filmschoolrejects.com. As of next week, when I write my next Game of Thrones article, we'll be a part of the Medium publishing platform. I'm very excited. It's going to load super fast and put all kinds of GIFs in my Game of Thrones thing just to test it out and see if I can handle it. But otherwise, follow me at Rejects. I'm going to be tweeting movie stuff all week, even though I won't be writing any articles between now and the 2nd of May, I think. We're going to be offline.
Oh, all right. I'm excited to see Medium because that's what you guys have been doing there thus far. It's looked amazing.
Yeah.
Looks really good. I am Joanna Robinson. You can find me in the same old place, vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can follow all of us on Twitter at Storm of Spoilers. And that's it.
You can also email us at Storm of Spoilers. Oh.
Or listen to me on A Cast of Kings if you don't already. Or listen to Dave and me on The Thought Bubble. I thought last week's episode of The Thought Bubble was really good, so you should check it out.
I'm going to listen to that one this week, my time off.
Yeah, we really laid into Doctor Strange and had all our opinions completely validated this week.
We sure did.
Super nice. I'm Dave Gonzalez. Spell my first name, DA7E. That's my Twitter handle. I write Latino-review.com and geek.com. And you could find all my other podcast work at fightinginthewarroom.com that includes all of this stuff at lastpagesofgreatbooks.com for your Game of Thrones.
Or stormofspoilers.com.
Or stormofspoilers.com. We're everywhere now, guys, because season 6 is back. It's Game of Thrones season. You know what that means? We'll see you next week.
A murder in her paradise.